The headlines this hour. Iran's defense minister dismisses the recent Israeli threats, saying that Tehran will give a crushing response to any unwise move. British households are bracing for a second large increase in energy bills in just 12 months as gas and electricity prices soar. And the ruling United Russia Party, which supports President Vladimir Putin, wins a sweeping majority in the country's parliament. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran's defense minister has played down the recent Israeli threats against his country, saying the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any unwise move. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani says that Israel's recent accusations against Iran were out of desperation. Ashtiani has warned that Tel Aviv will pay dearly for any act of aggression. The Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid recently accused Iran of, quote, marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid also threatened that the regime will act if the world fails to stop Iran from obtaining nuclear capabilities. Iran has time and again said that its nuclear program is non-military and is solely for civilian purposes, including power generation. Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making politically motivated decisions.
Iran has always cooperated with the IAEA. The agency, in return, should avoid making politically motivated decisions, remain impartial and independent, and also maintain its professional conduct.
Mohammad Islami was addressing the IAEA's 65th General Conference. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran slammed Israel's, quote, terrorist attacks against his country's nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Islami denounced the inaction of the UN and the IAEA on such measures. Further in his remarks, the official touched on the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran following Washington's unilateral pullout from the 2015 nuclear deal. Islami demanded that Washington remove the bans in a verifiable manner.
It is time the United States rectified its wrong policies and removed all sanctions in action and in an efficient and verifiable manner.
The Iranian official said the U.S. has no way but to abandon its, quote, addiction to sanctions. Islami highlighted the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign that Washington launched against Tehran following its 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. He said that Tehran seeks result-oriented talks with the aim of removing unfair sanctions. Iran has held several rounds of talks with the remaining parties to the nuclear deal to revive it and pave the way for the removal of U.S. sanctions. But the negotiations remain stalled due to what Tehran calls the excessive demands of Washington and its allies. Moving on with the news, gas prices have hit record highs in Britain, threatening consumers with huge power bills and small suppliers' futures. A leading trade association for the UK offshore oil and gas industry says that wholesale prices for gas are up 250% since January. The figure shows a 70% increase since August. Experts say that households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms risk collapsing. The hike is largely blamed on high global demand and a fire that knocked out a vital point connecting the country's power grid to France. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce. The government has held an emergency meeting over the issue. In Russia, partial results from the country's parliamentary elections show that the ruling United Russia Party has won the majority of votes. With nearly 75% of the ballots counted, United Russia is ahead with almost half of the votes. Its rival, the Communist Party, has managed to secure only about 20% of the votes. This comes as opposition parties have accused authorities of large-scale vote rigging, claiming that the election was in any case a sham. Meanwhile, the European Union has denounced what it called a climate of intimidation in the run-up to Russia's parliamentary vote and complained of a lack of independent observers. Also, Germany said that allegations of fraud in Russia's elections must be taken seriously and fully investigated. Marina Kortanova is a correspondent joining us from Moscow to tell us more. Tell us about the elections. Tell us the basic sentiment that Russians felt today in terms of how things turned out.
Well, nothing new. That elections to the 5th Russian State Duma, as you know, were held over a period of 3 days. So it started on September 17th and finished yesterday. In addition to the State Duma elections, voters went to the polls to cast ballots for the heads of 9 Russian regions and in elections for 39 regional parliaments. The ruling party, United Russia, secures 49.79% of the ballots on the party list to the State Duma, lower house of parliament, with 95.5% of the voting results processed. According to the preliminary results, United Russia secures 112 mandates on the list, and it is also dominating in 199 single-member constituencies. Thus, as a result, United Russia so far secures the constitutional majority in the Lower House. Over 300 mandates. The Communist Party comes second with 19.20%, followed by the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, 7.84%, a Just Russia Patriots for Truth, then goes the New People. Thus, these 5 parties broke through the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. And again, it will be the Duma of the Putin majority. Meanwhile, the team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier, before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office. At 100 and something, a polling station out of almost 1,000, 25,860 ballots were invalidated. So now we are talking about plots in 35 regions, including Moscow, St. Petersburg, Moscow region, and Crimea. So what do opposition leaders say? Because opposition is not very loud these days here in Russia. So they say that three-day voting coupled with electronic destroys elections as a political civil process, and it gives the authorities an absolute control over the course of voting. 3 days for the ability to customize state employees and draw numbers. Then they say that system fully controls the key political field and no usual techniques, political mobilization does not work and does not will work against the system. And the power can violate laws and norms and rules and is free to completely determine who and how keep the game. So they also say that democratic and radical left, the opposition is defeated, thrown out of the system of political field. And smart voting, which was suggested by Alexei Navalny, suffered a complete fiasco. The democratic and radical left opposition no longer exist legitimate instruments on influence on the political situation. The left rallied around the Communist Party received significant slap in the face in the form of 90%, which not only do not solve the issue getting into the Duma of radical representatives left flank, but strengthen the link of leadership faction of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation with the system of Putin state capitalism. This is what opposition say, because, well, there's the majority of United Russia again, and so people, people ask you why there is such a success of this party. So now I'm trying to explain another point of view.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your input here. That is our correspondent, Marina Kortanova, talking there. I'm going to cross on over now to London to talk to our correspondent, Mina Taylor, to tell us about the gas prices that are skyrocketing in the UK. Well, Mina, obviously some people may not be aware of this, so give us a recap, if you can, as to how we got to the point where there's a 250% increase from what we understand for wholesale gas prices.
Well, indeed, Calvi, that is going to be one of the major issues as winter approaches, because It's not only that this was in the works for some time, because obviously there's a supply and demand issue, especially post-COVID, post-Brexit, and the government knew this was coming. There are so many pensioners, people who are on reduced incomes and so on, who are going to be making a real, real difficult choice as the months get colder here in the UK about how much they should eat, whether how much they should heat their place. And we're not just talking about individual situations. As you mentioned when you did an excellent roundup of this item, that it has an impact on the supply chain. And it's only so far that manufacturers and supermarkets and other suppliers who will be able to hang on and take the hit for the new costs that they've incurred. What we're going to see here is from your heating bill to your food bill to the way in which you might run your vehicle, because we don't have the wind turbine situation that was estimated. There are still political issues about Nord Stream 2, which some might say would be a reasonable solution to this. Of course, the gas pipeline here from Russia into Germany, but because of political reasons, the UK might not lean into that. So we're now going to be in a situation where, unless this situation is curtailed and there is some kind of a solution, it's the average punter who will have to decide whether their pockets go deep enough. Because those smaller energy suppliers who were giving consumers a real choice, well, they're saying we can't sustain these hits going into the winter. We don't have deep enough pockets to ride through this storm. So fewer options mean higher prices for consumers in a time when we're going out of furlough. There are going to be question marks about what happens now in the job market. Terrible timing for Cave, and once again, it's the very poorest who will feel this impact in the most significant fashion.
Thank you, Amina. Muslims are descending on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'in. Pilgrims are marching on the Shrine City to join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The occasion this year falls on September 28th. The Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of the time over 13 centuries ago. The battle known as the Ashura event is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. Live, what you're seeing right there are Muslims who are converging on Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'in. You have many foreigners who are actually attending this also, many that come from Iran. You also have ones that are attending it from a variety of countries, from Persian Gulf countries. And as mentioned, this is an annual pilgrimage that sees millions of worshippers converging on the central city of Karbala on foot. The journey itself is a very highly spiritual journey for Muslims, but it's actually quite a sight to see. There's lots of happenings there throughout the what's called the pilgrimage on foot. As you can see there, people converging. And this, again, is something that happens on a yearly basis. And the occasion, Arba'in, marking 40 days after the commemoration of Ashura. One of the years that we aired this, there was a record where up to 29 million worshippers actually descended into Iraq for that occasion. Of course, it's hard to reach those numbers again because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but people are still steadfast in their belief and their support. Ceremonies are taking place to mark that. There are limitations in place because of the pandemic, but not so much as to stop people from coming out. Arba'in, which is best known in this case for the Arba'in March, as pilgrims traveling long distances, stretching tens of kilometers on foot to get to Imam Hussein's shrine in Karbala. Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making politically motivated decisions.
Iran has always cooperated with the IAEA. The agency, in return, should avoid making politically motivated decisions, remain impartial and independent, and also maintain its professional conduct.
Mohammad Islami was addressing the IAEA's 65th General Conference. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran slammed Israel's, quote, terrorist attacks against his country's nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Islami denounced the inaction of the UN and the IAEA on such measures. Further in his remarks, the official touched on the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran following Washington's unilateral pullout from the 2015 nuclear deal. Heslamy demanded that Washington remove the bans in a verifiable manner.
It is time the United States rectified its wrong policies and removed all sanctions in action and in an efficient and verifiable manner.
The Iranian official said the U.S. has no way but to abandon its, quote, addiction to sanctions. Heslamy highlighted the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign that Washington launched against Tehran following its 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. He said that Tehran seeks result-oriented talks with the aim of removing unfair sanctions. Iran has held several rounds of talks with the remaining parties to the nuclear deal to revive it and pave the way for the removal of U.S. sanctions. But the negotiations remain stalled due to what Tehran calls the excessive demands of Washington and its allies. Iran says its growing COVID vaccine imports and accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization came after regional countries realized that Tehran is no longer focused on the West. President Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks, criticizing some officials for tying the imports or the SCO membership to the ratification of the regulations of the Financial Action Task Force. Raisi said that Iran can achieve many of its objectives by reliance on domestic capabilities. This comes as the country is speeding up its mass vaccination drive, which has seen some 42 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines administered so far. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Economic divide.
The U.S. pullout from Afghanistan was a messy one. 20 years later, and after $3 trillion or more in spending, the U.S. has pulled out. But is that the end of the war machine? Definitely not. Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how the U.S. is gathering up its resources and energy to deal with its arch foe, China. Coming up in today's program, the U.S.-Afghan pullout, the U.S. readying for serious engagement with China, economically and even militarily. This reset, can it pull it off? Or is it too late to stop China's economic prowess? We'll have to wait and see. One of the other highlights of this program, Afghanistan, not the last U.S. pullout. Reports of U.S. pulling out of Syrian bases, Iraq, as it has stated, and maybe even Yemen. Even the U.S. said the U.S. was bogged down in West Asia for too long. is that a retreat for the U.S.? And finally, the economic challenges for the U.S. in dealing with China, technologically and through trade. But doesn't the U.S. need China more than China needing the U.S.?
The U.S. decision to withdraw from Afghanistan marks the U.S. defeat of time and money. The Afghan war cost the U.S. taxpayers over $2 trillion in revenues, in which interest on the loan to carry out that will be paid for years to come. This pullout, however, has posed an opportunity for a new geopolitical space for China. And if the U.S. continues to withdraw from countries in the West Asia region, like Syria, Iraq, and possibly its support for Yemen, this may give China, and maybe even Russia, a chance to fill that space.
Well, most of the countries realize that the situation has changed from the time with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where you really had one superpower. That one superpower has exerted its power in a variety of ways, not least of all in Afghanistan, as a dismal failure. And most of the countries have seen that. People are not generally, they don't hate the United States, but they're very cautious in dealing with the U.S. because of this this intensive feeling among many of the political elites here in the United States that we have got to set the rules.
Countries like Russia, Iran, Pakistan, and Persian Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia will more likely welcome a more active China, especially with the expansion of the Belt and Road Initiative. So detrimental to U.S.'s so-called superpower image was the Afghan pullout that East Asian countries like Japan and South Korea may also think twice about siding with the U.S. in countering China.
I mean, even countries like in Europe, even our so-called allies, really frown on the fact that the United States should not be the rule setter, that other countries have to have a say because they have a general interest. And in particular, most of the countries realize that China, which they don't always understand so well, really also wants to have a say in what direction the world goes in. And from what we can see of their own development, there's a lot of positive things they're doing. The Belt and Road Initiative, this has brought development to a world where development had been lacking for the last two or three decades.
So obviously, think tanks in the U.S. believe that U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was indeed necessary, not only because it was due time, but also because the threat that the U.S. sees from China, whether perceived or not, requires a lot of resources and money. Now, these are the main points of their argument. First, it could liberate military resources for the U.S. currently that was tied down in Afghanistan, allowing them to be redeployed to the Indo-Pacific theater, as it's called. And then it could also free up the diplomatic and bureaucratic bandwidth of U.S. senior officials. And finally, it could save the U.S. government money, unlocking billions of dollars that could be better devoted to fund initiatives that would boost America's standing in its competition with China. Well, our guest joining us for this edition of the program is Zhao Hei. He is a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics and Politics at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Okay, Zhao, welcome. Do you see a relation between the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan and the way that the U.S. wants to deal with China in the economic and technological sphere in respect to where the U.S. is trying to allocate and channel its resources to confront China and to not continue spending it in places like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think these two things are very much connected. And as we all know, since 2017, American national security strategy has changed. And since then, the U.S. has been trying to focus on China and reallocate its strategic assets towards the so-called Indo-Pacific area, and particularly focus on China. So under that overall strategy, continue to pour resources into Afghanistan is very problematic and strategically not worth it. So I think that's why, since the Trump administration, the U.S. has determined to pull out of Afghanistan, and actually President Biden just finished the job. And so far you can see that I think continuously the U.S. will move its assets, military intelligence, and other assets towards the Asia-Pacific, and particularly focus on China, as I said. And the U.S. will use more other methods, including export controls, sanctions, and other non-military methods against China, instead of trying to continue to use its superior military capability around the world.
Time now for our InfoNews section, where we will look at stories that may become topics for our next program. Now, for our first story, we're going to take a look at China and its rejection of big tech. This article stated that China's rejection of big tech monopoly capitalism is the focus for China, and it doesn't want to basically see China going the route that the U.S. has done. First of all, how is it going to be able to do that? Well, it's going to refuse allowing its homegrown technology companies to be dominant in the way that Amazon and Google are in the West. We can mention Alibaba, for example. And basically, it wants to put its focus on manufacturing, to make a long story short. Next up, BRICS Summit. It had one, and the BRICS nations, composed of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, it's an important meeting, have met. The host country, even though it was a virtual meeting, I should say the host was the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And he focused on three things which were the theme of the summit, the three C's: cooperation, for continuity, and consolidation. Now, BRICS is still relevant because it does have investments for its member countries into different sectors. Next up, U.S. national debt, obviously a big factor for the U.S., and it's on track to default, as of the recording of this program, on its national debt for the month of October. We have to wait and see if that happens. By the time this program gets aired, maybe it's going to be solved. But it's an ongoing problem. Basically, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said that if this happens and the debt limit is not raised, it will be the first time in U.S. history. This is basically has come out to be a bipartisan theatrical politics, so to speak, because at the end it always gets solved. Finally, breaking U.S. sanctions. Yes, Iran has done it again, delivering its first fuel shipment to Lebanon. That is a big deal because it shows that the U.S. sanctions did not work. Iran is invincible towards it. In this particular case, Lebanon needs the fuel badly. The way it did it, it entered Syria to transfer to Lebanon and did that via tankers.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's not enough for our in-depth section. Here we are going to devote what the U.S. may lose by focusing on China after pulling out of Afghanistan. First, the U.S. needs China more than China needs the U.S. economically speaking. For example, the U.S. depends heavily on China for providing low-cost goods. Now, this is especially applicable when it comes to income-constrained American consumers. Now, these are American consumers who are having a hard time making ends meet. Now, moving on to the other area where the U.S. depends on China, it has to deal with exports. China is America's third largest export market, next to Mexico and Canada. That obviously is something that should concern the U.S. Now, the U.S. also depends on China to provide funding for its budget deficit. You can see over here $1.3 trillion is how much debt or foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities China has in direct ownership. Imagine the lack of Chinese buying. That could turn the next Treasury auction into a rout. And finally, this is a bit of truth that is the outcome of the structure of the U.S. economy's weakness when it comes to Americans' spending habits. America depends on China because Americans don't have enough savings. For example, in the fourth quarter of 2017, the net domestic saving rate was just 1.3%. That was the national income. Now, how will we be able to increase Americans' savings? Well, in order to consume and grow, the U.S. must import surplus foreign savings from abroad. That is the naked truth. And run massive balance of payments and trade deficits to import this capital. But how can it do that when the U.S. had trade deficits with 102 nations? That's right, 102 nations. Okay, let's bring in William Jones for a breakdown. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review and a non-resident fellow of Pyongyang Institute for Financial Studies. Bill Jones, welcome. Why did the U.S. fall behind China, estimated to take over the U.S. as the number one economy by the year 2028? I mean, is it because of the U.S. spending monies on wars, for example, across the globe and its military bases, instead of focusing on things like infrastructure or education and scientific development in areas like 5G?
Well, obviously, the situation of Afghanistan has created a situation where the United States, which is pulled out, doesn't really have much influence on the development in Afghanistan. They have no representations on site. They're withholding money to the Taliban and waiting and see what happens. China, on the other hand, has really taken a forward position here. They do have a relationship with the Taliban. They are willing to help the Taliban in its turn. Has said that they really would want to work with China. So, but the U.S. is still concerned with what happens in Afghanistan because it doesn't want it to become a center of terrorism and have the same problems they had 20 years ago with the 9/11 situation. Will the United States stop their freedom of navigation forays into the China Sea? Will they stop trying to impose a technological apartheid on China through trade tariffs, and I don't think that's going to happen. But there has to be some give in this situation on the part of the U.S. in order to maintain stability in the relationship.
The story of the U.S. losing its status as a so-called superpower is being highlighted these days, especially after its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. Marred by COVID-19, its economy has not fully recovered from the pandemic.
There's still clearly a huge amount of open positions. There's still clearly a shortage in some industries. There's still clearly a problem with some industries that require more certifications and things like that are time dependent.
In the meantime, under these harsh circumstances for the U.S., it is insisting on confronting China. China, in the meantime, has achieved success in its fight against poverty. It has put forth the grand vision under the leadership of its president, Xi Jinping, to vitalize its rural areas in its fight against poverty.
President Xi Jinping rightly celebrates the success of China's targeted poverty alleviation campaign, which by the end of last year, 2020, had brought about 100 million of the intractably poor out of extreme poverty. For China to achieve the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation, eliminating extreme poverty was necessary, but it was not sufficient. China must continue to fight poverty by reducing still substantial relative poverty and close the still excessive wealth gap, primarily between rural and urban areas. Enhancing rural standards of living exemplifies China's long-range vision to the years 2035 and 2050, when China's goal is to become a fully modernized socialist nation. And President Xi allows no delay in making the historic transition from poverty alleviation to rural vitalization. Without the vitalization of the countryside, there can be no social stability, no common prosperity, no national rejuvenation. But while grand visions are formulated by central leadership, they must be implemented by local grassroots officials.
It has also issued a white paper to elaborate on its prosperity. The white paper said that China had completed the historic transformation from poverty to securing access to food and clothing, to a decent life, and finally, to moderate prosperity. This against the unsuccessful backdrop of U.S. efforts.
They've also gone for poverty, the first country, biggest country in the world, which has effectively eliminated extreme poverty. We haven't even done that in the United States. And those are things that I think should be markers for most countries and for humanity at large. And most of the countries in the world realize that this is a positive element here, and they want to work together with it. So I don't think they're going to simply follow the bugle call of the United States to go to a conflict.
But the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has one main purpose: to secure its resources and to channel it against China. And it is not just Afghanistan that the U.S. has withdrawn its forces from. Drawdowns have been reported in Iraq and in Syria, with Yemen to maybe in the works. The West Asia region is no longer of U.S. interest, and the reason may be purely for profits. Brown University's Costs of War Project released a report that revealed that the Pentagon spending totaled over $14 trillion since the start of the war in Afghanistan, with one-third to one-half of the total going to military contractors. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget, as the report reads.
Well, I think the U.S. Current relative decline has multiple sources. One, of course, is that after 9/11, the U.S. has very much invested in the so-called war on terror, and invests so much that its domestic need has not been met. So over the years, we've seen numbers like very high numbers that the U.S. has invested in its war capabilities, and it's deploying military around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in Central Asia. So that's really a waste of money. However, a small group of Americans really benefited from this, and a U.S. Stock market, the capital market, also benefited from this. During this time, as you said, there are many domestic problems should be taken care of, but not being taken care of because of political divide within the United States. So, and you know, political difficulties blocking that solution. So as we've seen over the past two decades, the infrastructure is lagging behind, and also there's a serious problem of social and economic gap between the rich and the poor. So moving forward, I think the number one priority for the U.S. should take care of its domestic problem instead of intervening into other countries' internal affairs.
Southeast Asia will take a major economic hit if shipping is either disrupted or, worse yet, blocked in the South China Sea. Now, that's one of the points of conflict between the U.S. and China in what is known as the South China Sea conflict, and in particular, how that serves as a trade route. Now, the U.S. wants to take the revenues produced in that region. That's somewhat of an assumption, but it seems like that is the U.S.'s goal, to take those revenues away from China or decrease it by a substantial amount. Well, to get the final comments from our guests, Jia Hai, who's a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics, and also Bill Jones, who's a Washington bureau chief for the Executive Intelligence Review, both rejoining us for this final segment. Jia, I'm going to start with you and our final question, the U.S. superpower status downgraded by many across the world, many analysts, be it militarily or in the economic sphere, but the U.S. is still pursuing China on a military level. Does the U.S. alienation mean that it will not have the support of countries, not only in the Asia region, but also in Europe and elsewhere, in the respect where they're not going to be on board with it to confront China?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. continued to be the world's most powerful country, that's for sure. Even though with current relative decline, the U.S. still maintain a superior military power comparing to all the rest of the world combined, pretty much. So I think in that respect, U.S. continued to lead in its military realm. However, the world is now diversifying, and there are multipolar other powers arising, and this world order is changing from the post-Cold War unipolar into a multipolar world. Many other countries, including Europe and China and other developing countries groupings, are having a stake in international affairs. So U.S. has no monopoly on many other issues. Many other countries can contribute in the area of like the pandemic or climate change or urgent issues that humanities are facing currently.
All right, well, Bill, the U.S. superpower status downgraded by many, as was mentioned here, whether it's militarily or in the economic sphere, and it has fallen behind China, which is set to overtake the U.S. Economically by the year 2028 for it to be the number one economy. Is it because of the U.S. spending expenditures on wars across the globe that this has happened to the U.S.? We could mention military bases and military spending overall.
Well, yes, that latter is both are the case. The fact that they have spent a lot of money in military wars, which have led really nowhere except to further devastation. Afghanistan is a prime example of that. You can also look in the Middle East and see the same type of situation. But also there's been an utter neglect of investment in science and technology. And what the Chinese have done, with a population of 1.4 billion people, by the way, is they have followed much the example that the United States was following in the 1960s. We have to continue, you know, exerting ourselves. The almighty dollar will buy whatever we need, and therefore we don't have to do a lot of investment in science and technology, so that they became, in many respects, backwards, and the Chinese have moved forward. U.S. still remains a major scientific power, and I'm sure
the so-called superpower status of the U.S. is in jeopardy, and the U.S. is declining in its might, both in its economy and also its military. Yes, even the military, because the U.S. can't win a conflict by air, and its ground forces, well, they couldn't even defeat the Taliban when they had 100,000 forces combined with NATO forces in that country. And now they want to take on China in the business and military arena. So desperate that the U.S. had to send its VP Harris recently to Asia to rally support around her during her recent visit of the regional countries, that is. And as far as U.S. war adventurism is concerned, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, need I say more? No wins there. So obviously, remains to be seen how the U.S. is going to be able to even penetrate China's sphere economically and militarily. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. From Mika Batahwe and the entire team, this is goodbye until next time.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today I have made a trip to the beautiful city of Neishabur in Khorasan Razavi province. And my destination is a part of the nature of this great city, the Haftqar Valley. Stay with me. Neishabur is the second populated city of Khorasan Razavi province after the city of Mashhad. Neishabur has become a symbol of Iranian culture and history because of its rich culture and long history. This city is located on the foothills of Binalud mountain range, so its nature is untouched and extraordinary. Haftqar Valley, literally Seven Caves Valley, is a beautiful valley north of Neishabur. Haftqar Valley has a special red clay which is highly considered by environmentalists and climatologists. Haftqar Valley has nothing to do with a cave. Rather, the similarity of these valleys, defiles to caves, have made it to be called by this name. The impact of soil erosion in this valley gives it a new shape after every rainfall. The precipitation also makes temporary seasonal waterfalls. I am now in Haftqar Valley of Neishabur. Across from me, there are red-colored rocks, which I cannot describe their beauty and magnificence. You have to be here to realize what I'm saying. And beside me, there are many trees and bushes, which I don't know their names, unfortunately. However, they have given a special green look to this region. What a pretty spring. The sound of this spring makes me calm. And it has cool water. The water of this spring is not drinkable because it has many minerals. Such kinds of springs and rivers are abundant in Haftgar Valley. Look, there is a deep, beautiful split in the heart of this red rock. I better get closer. Oh, what a steep slope. Oh, please do remember that you have to be in a good physical condition if you want to take a tour here. Oh, at last I arrived. Oh, what a cozy corner. I'd like to sit here and take a rest. As if all the peace and calm in the world is in here. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.